and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on Horseshoe Casino opening a sports book. The Hobart Walmart has reopened following a weekend shooting. Jenny Lindsay reports on the release of the new iLearn exam results. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with One Region President and CEO Leah Conradi. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Are you ready to wager on some football? That's the question Horseshoe Casino General Manager Dan Nita shouted Wednesday to dozens of sports fans and gamblers before cutting the ribbon on The Book, the second sports betting facility to open this week in Northwest Indiana. Unlike the comparatively simple betting counter at East Chicago's Ameristar Casino, The Book is similar to Las Vegas casinos with a location right on the gaming floor, 52 wide leather seats with cup holders, and a wall of 30 video boards showing sporting events and wagering odds. The Times reports professional football appeared to be the subject of most bets being placed ahead of Thursday's seasoning opening clash between the Chicago Bears and Green Bay Packers at Soldier Field. Former Chicago Bears running back Matt Forte, who was on hand for the grand opening of The Book, said that while he's not a regular gambler, said he's betting this year on the Bears because I know how good that team is. Hammond Mayor Thomas McDermott Jr. said he's a Bears believer and even put his money where his mouth was. The four-term leader of Lake County's most populous city placed the first official bets at the Horseshoe, wagering $100 on the Bears to win the Super Bowl, $50 on Notre Dame to win the College Football National Championship, and $50 on the Chicago Cubs to win the World Series. The Horseshoe, Ameristar, and the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, which opens its sports book Thursday, are likely to see thousands of people from Illinois coming through their doors in the months ahead, since the Illinois Gaming Board has not yet adopted the regulations necessary for Illinois casinos to accept sports bets following the June enactment of a state law authorizing sports wagering. The Book is a smoke-free area that covers approximately 5,300 square feet on the casino floor, at the base of the escalator that goes to the Village Square Buffet and the venue concert hall. It's open from 8 a.m. to midnight on Saturdays and Sundays, 11 a.m. to midnight on Mondays, 11 a.m. to midnight on Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays, and 11 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Winning wagers can be cashed 24 hours a day at the main casino cashier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
It's back to a normal week for Walmart after a customer was shot and wounded Sunday in the produce section of the Hobart store. The Times reports shoppers on Wednesday, 3 days after the shooting, were cruising the aisles for bargains and were somewhat fatalistic about the weekend violence. Some who commented on the Times Facebook page expressed their contempt on social media for the discount retailer and the customers it draws. Other readers used the weekend violence as the latest debating point on gun control. Some said they wouldn't shop there because of Walmart's announcement this week it would discontinue sales of certain gun ammunition and request that customers not carry firearms into the store. But inside and outside the store, in the 2900 block of East 79th Avenue on Wednesday, it appeared to be just another shopping day. About 100 cars were in the parking lot, including a Crown Point police car and a Lake County Police squad car perched by the grocery store entrance. A uniformed police officer stood guard by the produce section. One security guard said the day after the shooting, customers came up and thanked them for being there. The only yellow tape to be seen was around an area in the entrance
where workers were removing old fractured concrete and pouring new concrete walkways to a store that has been serving Hobart, Miraville for decades. Hobart Fire Department, Miraville Fire Department, Lake County Sheriff's Department, and federal investigators were swarming those entrances at 3 p.m. Sunday when shots were fired. An off-duty East Chicago police officer took a man into custody. He later was released. Police also arrested a woman with him, but later released her. The Lake County Prosecutor's Office has yet to file charges in the case. It was the second shooting at the store in less than a year.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Authorities say three officers shot at a car break-in suspect who stole a road maintenance vehicle and fled. Indiana State Police say the Valparaiso Police Department got a call Wednesday afternoon about three males trying to break into cars, and an officer spotted the suspects driving shortly afterward. The vehicle fled an attempted traffic stop and ended up on the Indiana toll road before crashing. Police say three males fled on foot into a wooded area. Two were caught, and a third stole an unoccupied maintenance vehicle, hitting a semi-truck and driving at a maintenance worker. State police say a Porter County deputy and two troopers fired at him. He eventually crashed and was injured. Police say he had non-life-threatening injuries.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Road closure, lane restrictions, and detours ahead. Those are the signs motorists traveling through the area, including Crown Point and Munster, can expect in the coming weeks as road work continues in the region. Night-only closures will run Monday through Wednesday at the 109th Avenue and Delaware Parkway intersection on Crown Point's east side. Crown Point Chief of Staff Greg Falkowski says that's so grounding and paving can take place with a final service coat to be placed later. The intersection will be closed from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. so that daily commuters won't be affected. He goes on to say detour signs are in place for those driving through the area at night. Those with questions are asked to contact Crown Point's engineering office at 219-662-3242. Munster Town Manager Dustin Anderson said motorists traveling along 45th Avenue west of Calumet Avenue should anticipate lane restrictions and possible delays.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The state released results for the new iLearn exam at the State Board of Education meeting Wednesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports just how much lower test scores looked compared to previous state exams.
Fewer than half of all students in Indiana reached proficiency on either the English language arts or math part of the test, and just more than a third of Hoosier students reached proficiency on both. On the 2018 ISTEP, the test iLearn replaced, about half of Hoosier kids passed both math and ELA. But Director of Assessment Charity Flores says the drop in scores was expected in part because iLearn covers some content kids haven't been tested on before.
We also are assessing content on iLearn that had previously not been assessed fully.
The State Board of Education will delay assigning school letter grades until lawmakers can take action to avoid penalizing schools for the lower scores. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The achievement gap between white students and their Black, Hispanic, and multiracial peers remains, according to the results of the iLearn exam. From Indiana Public Broadcasting, Eric Weddle has more.
Governor Eric Holcomb and other education leaders say the 2019 iLearn scores should not be used to calculate school letter grades and teacher evaluations. But others, like State Board of Education member Tony Walker, say the scores show a need to improve outcomes for all students, including minorities and those at the lowest performing schools.
Scores are what they are. And, you know, schools and school districts need to locally start addressing their individual situations reflected by this, and it's not a problem with this test probably. So we need to figure out what the problem is and fix it.
Less than 15% of Black students and less than a quarter of Hispanic students in grades 3 through 8 pass both the math and English portions of the iLearn exam. White students pass both test parts at 43%. Overall, just 37% of Indiana students pass both parts of the test. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Teachers have rallied at schools and the State House all year to push for better pay and more respect for their profession. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports, teachers flocked to the Governor's Teacher Pay Commission input meetings last month to reinforce an idea. Indiana's education policy doesn't respect public educators.
Teachers listed a number of issues, including low pay leading to a shrinking pool of future teachers, a flawed school funding system, and a state legislature actively complicating their jobs. John Hurley ran for a seat in the General Assembly last year. He says lawmakers could find money for teachers by phasing out the state's voucher program and capping funding for charter schools.
We have the money to do this to help. We just have to make that decision.
Other solutions offered at the meetings include funding unfunded mandates, cutting back on testing, and giving teacher unions more bargaining rights. The commission will send lawmakers recommendations to boost teacher compensation before the 2021 legislative session. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The state has approved a new round of school safety grant funding for Indiana schools. The money will go to more than 400 schools through the state's Secured School Safety Grant Program. Lawmakers allocated more than $19 million for the fund earlier this year, a $5 million boost. Schools can use the money for school resource officers, threat assessments, and building upgrades. Lawmakers changed the program this year to let schools use funding for firearm training for teachers if their district allows educators access to guns. The grants come with a matching requirement. The department estimates state funding and local matching grants through the program will provide more than $35 million for school safety projects in Indiana this year.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The state will receive $21 million over the next 3 years to prevent drug overdose deaths. The money from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, will be used to improve data collection, increase prescription drug monitoring, and provide harm reduction training. The Indiana State Department of Health says the number of drug overdose deaths declined in 2018 compared to the prior year.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Hoosier Lottery generated a record amount of revenue for the state over the last year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the numbers unveiled Tuesday.
The state will get $312 million from the Hoosier Lottery based on revenue from the fiscal year that ended in June. That's the most ever, $6 million better than last year. The bulk of that money goes into the Build Indiana Fund, which primarily helps reduce the amount Hoosiers have to pay for their vehicle registration at the BMV. The rest of the lottery money goes to teacher and police and firefighter pension funds. The private company, IGT Indiana, that runs the lottery, exceeded the revenue target it needed to hit, meaning it will get an $11 million bonus this year. Lottery revenues have increased in 5 of the 6 years IGT Indiana has run the program. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Across the United States, there's a push to give new doctors special training to work with refugees and other immigrants. And some say it's the difference between healthy and sick patients. SideFX Public Media's Carter Barrett reports.
On this block on Indianapolis's south side, there's not one, but three international grocery stores here. There's Soraga International Grocery, Tienda Morelos, and Chin Asian Grocery. A newspaper clipping from 1965 says a half century ago this area was almost all white and hostile to minorities. Now a community of Burmese refugees, along with a growing subset of Congolese and Syrian refugees, call this Southside suburb home. And several miles down the road is the Franciscan Health Family Medicine Center.
So we have our kind of underserved Southside population, and then we also have a significant amount of immigrants and refugees.
That's Adam Parlberg, a family medicine doctor at the center. He trains medical residents who help staff this clinic. On this day, around 24 of these residents are watching a MARTI demonstration. That's M-A-R-T-T-I, a system that connects doctors with live interpreters for over 250 languages. It looks like an iPad on a rolling stand. At the front of the room, Parlberg and a medical assistant are staging an exam as part of the training session. The MARTI interpreter will translate his words.
If she has any like headaches or dyspnea or right quadrant pain, edema, vision changes, bleeding, cramping, contractions, abdominal pain, that sort of stuff, probably needs to come to the triage, but we'll see her next week. All right, thank you.
The residents are laughing because Parlberg demonstrated some of the don'ts of working with an interpreter. He asked long, rambling questions and used confusing medical jargon.
As you can imagine, if you tell the patient to break a leg or, you know, this is going to cost you an arm and a leg, you know, there might not be an equivalent there and it can be taken very differently. And
second-year resident Michael Padilla says the demonstration made him more aware of the complexity of translations.
Like, one of the things that we learned that was really cool today is there's no word for anxiety, so they have to describe that. Yeah, and just how some things can get translated, like how you got here turned into how did you make this appointment.
But this training is about cultural considerations too, like knowing to address mental illness, which can be taboo in some cultures. Parlberg says patients sometimes complain of physical symptoms.
They may come in with a headache or abdominal pain or dizziness or something like that.
This means mental illness can go undiagnosed unless a doctor understands cultural clues. Parlberg says training residents to be aware of these considerations isn't just about niceties.
The patient doesn't feel like that you're being mindful or understanding or culturally sensitive. I mean, you've already lost that person. That person's not going to follow your instructions. They're not going to be compliant with medical care and follow-up and that sort of thing.
And more medical schools are offering this type of training. Here's David Acosta with the Association of American Medical Colleges.
This new generation has a large interest, in getting these experiences. And so medical schools basically are really pushing hard to try to provide those experiences to them.
Of the medical schools the association surveys, more than 60% now offer training on cultural competency. This is up from just 30% several years ago. Parlberg says preparing future doctors to work with people from different cultures isn't just for big cities anymore. Even rural hospitals need it. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Local healthcare company InHealth Integrated Care is part of the response team to help the victims of Hurricane Dorian. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with Ryan Donahue, CEO of InHealth Ambulance, about the company sending some of its associates down to an area affected by the storm.
Tell me about what you are doing. I understand you're sending some ambulances down to Georgia. And tell me a little bit about, you're based in Valparaiso. Tell me about what your company is.
All right, so it's InHealth Ambulance. We have bases in Lake Porter, LaPorte, and St. Joe County. And we have a partnership with FEMA and AMR. And any kind of natural disaster that happens around the country, we typically get called upon to send ambulances to. This will be our fourth hurricane in 3 years that we've gone to. And, you know, they called us yesterday and put us on alert that we might be deployed. So at that point, we kind of get volunteers from our staff that's willing to go. I mean, they get paid, but they are going to be gone for up to 2 weeks, you know, away from their families. And it's a pretty big commitment to just kind of drop everything and go. So about 2:30 or 3 this morning, we got the call that they've made the decision to send, you know, resources down there in preparation for the hurricane. They're expecting it to be pretty bad. So we had like 4 hours to get everybody ready. So we've got four associates going down and two ambulances. We're heading to Georgia. The crew is heading to Georgia now. And once they get there, then they're going to be deployed on wherever they feel the hurricane's going to make landfall. So that, you know, it's kind of hard to say where that's going to be at this point, but they do think, you know, mid to southern Florida sometime on Sunday.
And your company is based out of Valparaiso?
That's where our corporate office is in Valparaiso, but we have bases in Highland, La Porte, and South Bend as well.
So you said you have four associates going down?
Yeah, four associates and two ambulances. So EMT's going down, and, you know, this morning we had the mechanics come in and make, you know, check over the vehicles, make sure everything was good, and then also, you know, stock up on extra supplies and oxygen. And because they could be, you know, out doing calls back-to-back for a 24-hour period. They could be back at Air Force bases. It really depends. Each time we go, it's a little bit different, just depending upon the emergency. So they have to be pretty self-sufficient. They've got, you know, extra food and supplies and toiletries and all that to make sure that, you know, they're taking care of themselves while they're out there taking care of the patients, too. It'll range from nursing home evacuations to just helping people out of their houses, you know, kind of whatever the community needs. And our crews do it and we do it. You know, we know that when we had the floods years ago, people came in to help us in our communities, and that's kind of why we do it. And each of the crews go through specialized, it's called NIM, so it's National Incident Management Training, and it's to, you know, people will be working together from all over the country. So this training kind of makes it easy for them to communicate and understand, like, the hierarchy and, you know, structure when you're dealing in these big mass casualty or mass injury types of scenarios, just how everybody interacts with each other. So we go through this training throughout the year to be prepared for these situations. And, you know, I've got, the crew's been texting me pictures. One cool thing they just sent me was that they're now in a convoy with another group of a tree cutting company, because they know there's going to be power lines and trees down. So now kind of all these emergency vehicles are kind of finding each other and traveling together. I know in the past, ComEd and NIPSCO and all those guys have gone. So they've just sent pictures of the ambulances with these tree cutting places.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Leah Conradi.
Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next guest here on the program is Lee Conradi, who's the president and CEO of One Region. And One Region is a nonprofit, a 501c3, that his mission is to grow population, attract and retain talent, increase household income here in Northwest Indiana, in Lake Porter and La Porte counties, and more recently has taken on another title of being in charge of the Northwest Indiana Regional Opportunities Council. Thank you for joining us in the program, and will you tell us a little bit about what the council is all about?
Thank you, Chris. So the council is focused on how to attract investments and people to Northwest Indiana. It was created about a year ago. It's a council of CEOs and executives from the private sector and institutions throughout Lake Porter and La Porte counties. And their top priorities are, again, like, how do you get people to move here and what does that look like? So it's about creating vibrancy and density in our urban core areas, ensuring that the South Shore Train and its projects happen, such as double tracking and the Westlake extension, fostering transit-oriented development, and then also a focus on the Marquette Greenway.
When you have such an ambitious project like this in particular, how do you go about to get started, since we know that, the South Shore Line has well stated what its intentions are with the expansion of not only the service that's out there now, the routes from Gary to Michigan City on the double tracking section, but also to the West Lake project as well. How do you get things started to try to attract not only people to be able to live in places along the rail line, but also businesses to locate, too?
That's a good question. I mean, there's always a starting place, and that's why we created this council, was to create a focus of what do they see as the top priority and how do you create those investments and a strategy around these priorities. And so one of the things that I've looked at is transit-oriented development, and we've had our South Shore Rail Line for over 100 years, but we're probably one of the only places in the country that has zero transit-oriented development. So One Region has led trips to New Jersey, Pittsburgh, and Denver to learn about how these places create a turnaround strategy. And each place has a different story. But what I have found is the private sector has to come to the table, work with the public sector, and create that investment. So the piece that I've specifically looked at with the council is how do you create that investment for gap financing around real estate development? So after going to Pittsburgh, we learned about the Pittsburgh Strategic Investment Fund. We've looked at equitable TOD funds in Indianapolis and Denver. And today we officially launched and announced a $25 million loan and investment program for transit-oriented development in Northwest Indiana, which is very exciting and has, I would say, multiple banks have come together, and they're all members of our Opportunities Council to create this. So we're pretty excited about it.
Do you think that maybe that it's hard to say, you know, what the reasons may have been years ago as the South Shore Line had developed over the years, but do you think it was because it was just a matter of creating the right-of-way, so to speak, or the way for the train tracks and the stations that go along with it to develop over time, and maybe nobody really thought about kind of upgrading the neighborhoods and to be able to include more housing and more business opportunities and the like along those lines?
Not necessarily. I think that, you know, I would use the line that the former mayor of Oklahoma City said, which was that Oklahoma City was built for cars. So if you were a car, Oklahoma City was the place to be. And mm-hmm. So I think that as our region developed, we were kind of that suburban community, and people were driving to the train stations as opposed to creating that walkable factor. And I think our downtowns and urban core areas have seen a shift in population during, you know, the 1970s and 80s, and now it's time to reinvest in that. And that's, you know, Pittsburgh's a good story of what happens when you have a population decline and how do you reinvest to bring people back. And so that's a part of the strategy, is this real estate development strategy.
Now,
I think it's a matter of time, basically.
Does this project in particular, when you're talking about the opportunity for the loan program and the funds that are targeted for these development projects along the route, both routes, actually, we should say, do they come, I guess, in conjunction with whatever the South Shore Line is planning to do?
In terms of the transit-oriented development?
Yeah.
I think that, yeah, so as communities are looking at what is transit-oriented development, development mean to them, the state of Indiana has been very supportive on this too. They recently, in the last 2 years, passed legislation for transit development districts, and that's to help incentivize creating transit-oriented development. And so this is just another step of how do you leverage financing for that. And the state is looking at TOD, transit-oriented development, within a half mile, and we're looking closer to stations at a quarter mile. We're using that as a guideline. So we really want to create that walkable amenity around transit stations.
Do you think this is going to be an opportunity here more for, it's going to be a mixed use of projects, I'm sure. So you'll have all types of not only housing, but you'll have business and maybe some commercial in there too. But do you think this maybe might be focused a bit more toward housing? Because we know that the opportunities would be there for people to take the train, say to live in Northwest Indiana, and take the train to go to Chicago, or take the train even to go to South Bend.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we are focused on mixed use development, and that includes housing and then retail generally on the first floor. But we're looking for creative and high quality projects. We're looking for all types of housing projects. I think our, you know, focus is especially on market rate housing, which we lack here in the region, especially in terms of rental properties. And we know that that is attractive to both empty nesters and young professionals. So.
Those are probably the people, I'm sure, that are the most attractive to being able to take the train, even for just for a half hour or however it takes to get to whatever their stops are in Chicago.
Absolutely. It is very attractive, and I think that we could do a better job at retaining our talent and, you know, college grads if we had the type of place that they're looking to live, which is walkable rental properties, and that's a gateway to the housing market and home ownership. So, I mean, I think it's a win-win of, you know, creating this investment in development in Northwest Indiana.
Now, I know the council is made up of CEOs and executives in the three counties that are in best use for this, certainly this project, Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. Although the council is focusing here, at least in this particular case, on the loan program involving the banks that are members of the council, what do some of the CEOs and the executives and some of the other business and industry and nonprofits have to say about this?
Everyone's excited. Everyone's in on transit-oriented development and creating that walkable feature. And, you know, I'll use as an example, like downtown Hammond. And downtown Hammond has a Franciscan Hospital, has a court system, has Drack and Van Til, has, Purdue Northwest, not too far. And many, you know, Franciscans, Drack and Van Til, Purdue Northwest are all members of the Opportunities Council. And so for them to have that added value of investing in transit-oriented development in downtown Hammond, and that is just a win-win-win for everybody, not just for Hammond, but for the entire region. And so, again, that's an example. Michigan City is another place that is prime for an opportunity like this. And, again, other business and corporate partners see the value in places across the region, but it's, everybody is excited about it.
Do you think that this is really going to be a truly transformative project? When we talk about, for example, the just working on the main line, double tracking in particular here between Gary and through Michigan City, this is going to do a lot of changing of the landscape and how the trains are running through the region anyway. Do you think that's just going to lend itself even more to a development for this much more dense housing?
I do. I think that we, each municipality and we as a region and we as a private sector have to be intentional about what it is we're looking for. So I want to see from the public sector what their plans are. They need to be intentional about the type of development they want to see. You know, as the former mayor of Pittsburgh has said, not every deal is a good deal. So make sure you know what you want and be very clear about that. And that's been a strong lesson from every place we've looked at. But I think that there's got to be some help on those early projects that have a higher risk because our market isn't caught up yet. And it will once we have some anchor projects and catalytic projects that come to our region.
So there has to be somebody who has to really take the plunge and become the initial developer that wants to come up with a really good idea that is going to take the best advantage of the land that's available to work with, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think, again, being intentional about it and smart about how you approach development and growth is helpful. But I've looked at places, you know, I would say it has to be a holistic project, right, and comprehensive of the community and what the community needs are. We've looked at, you know, an example in Newark, New Jersey, where it was a redeveloped building and it included housing, a Whole Foods, and Rutgers Newark became a part of it and had faith in it, and it really became an anchor for downtown Newark. And so it's projects like that that we're looking for that are truly anchors and catalytic in those early projects.
Now, Leah, do you think that in this particular case, when you're talking about a developer that is really interested in following through on the concept of transit-oriented development and with these mixed-use projects, housing and the commercial and the business and the like that's going to come along with it, does this new program lend itself a little differently than the traditional developer going to a bank or a series of banks to get the financing to be able to get the project started?
It doesn't. I mean, it's in some ways traditional financing, and in other ways it's a bit unique in that it's spreading the risk among five different banks, and also terms and conditions are, I would say we have guidelines that we're working with and would be set for each project, but we are looking for creative projects. So
now maybe it's a little early since you've just made the announcement of the new loan program, but are there any developers out there that have gotten with you folks at One Region and other members there of the original Opportunities Council to talk about this idea and say, hey, maybe we're really interested in this?
There are developers who are certainly interested in looking at transit-oriented development throughout Northwest Indiana and creative projects. And I've personally met with some, and I know that other people and organizations in Northwest Indiana have as well. So I think that this is helpful in moving development forward.
Now, getting to the nuts and bolts of this, now that the program is officially launched, what is the procedure now if there is a developer that is interested in taking advantage of it?
The best way is to contact me. You could reach out to the banks as well, but the best way is contact me and through my email or through our website, oneregionnwi.org. And we'll go from there. So we want to hear about projects and ideas, and you know, we're open to it. And we also want to hear, you know, and see from the public sector that municipalities are prepared and ready for development and have looked at the feasibility of projects and done a residential analysis. So we want to see alignment with the public sector as well.
Now, do you think this is going to be a project that not only involving the individual or groups of developers that will get working on this, but also with the communities that are along the line, and also, I guess, too, for that matter, with NERPC, which, of course, runs the South Shore Line?
Yes, I do. I do think that there will be alignment. I mean, I work frequently with our various regional organizations, and NICDI and RDA have been strong collaborators with One Region. And so, yes, continue to have conversations with them and work with them through this. And I do think municipalities will also reach out to us, as well as developers approach them about certain projects and looking at how do we finance the gap on those projects. So
now I'm assuming that over time we're going to see more information about this on the One Region website and other places too.
Absolutely.
Well, Leah, thank you for taking time to talk with us, explaining what the new development is in the program that the Northwest Indiana Regional Opportunities Council has gotten started, the loan program, working with the member banks on the council to get those developers who are interested in this unique transit-oriented development project going. And we wish you all the best, and thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was my pleasure, and look forward to growing Northwest Indiana together.
Leah Conrady is the president and CEO of One Region. They're based, by the way, in Munster, and they are the 501c3 that is working, among other things, to help grow population and attract and to retain not only talent but also increase household income here in Northwest Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking.
A monthly sustaining membership is the most convenient way to support Lakeshore Public Radio. It saves you time and hassle, and it saves Lakeshore Public Radio processing costs. You can sign up online or...
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.